Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight, my guest is Bruce Solheim. Before I bring him on, I have just a couple of announcements. First, I got another strike on YouTube, so I cannot upload there until next week. You can always get all new episodes free on Rockfin, Odyssey, and of course all podcast platforms. Second, I had a great time last week at the UFO Mega Conference, and we still have tons of content to upload. We're trying to get to that as soon as possible, and you will see it up as soon as we do. And we're going to be featuring some of the amazing presenters from the conference starting this month, so look for those coming up. And definitely check us out on Rockfin, where you can get all our premium content, you can get all our regular shows, and all the premium content from all the amazing content creators on Rockfin. Also, we finally have our merch store up. You get t-shirts, stickers, bags, all kinds of cool stuff. That link is in the description or fknstore.net. Be sure and check that out. And finally, check out the great products at Ascent Nutrition. They're an amazing all-natural health and nutrition company. Not only do they have supplement categories like vitality and energy, healthy metabolism and detoxification, you'll see brain and focus, and intuition and consciousness. I've been taking their nootropic focus, and man, my focus and attention is off the charts. If you're ready to optimize your meat suit, check out Ascent Nutrition. Tonight, I want to welcome Bruce Olav Solheim. He earned his PhD in history from Bowling Green State University in 1993. He is a distinguished professor of history at Citrus College in Glendora, California, and he has published 12 books and has written 10 plays, six of which have been produced. He has published a trilogy of nonfiction paranormal books, Timeless, Timeless Deja Vu, and Timeless Trinity. He also has a comic book and graphic novel featuring an alien hybrid character named Snark. He is back again to discuss his new book, Anzar the Progenitor. Bruce, welcome back. How are you?
Good. How are you, Chris?
I'm very good. It's always great talking with you. And I think it's been like almost a year since we last spoke, and so much has happened. Yeah. Last time you were on, we talked about some of your personal paranormal experiences and briefly touched on your encounters with Anzar. Tonight, we're going to go deeper into those experiences, and we're going to talk about your new book, which is Anzar the Progenitor. First, I'd like you to remind the audience a little bit about just your history with paranormal experiences in general.
Yeah, well, I've led a paranormal life since I was 4 or 5 years old. I started with a angelic healing experience, and that kind of opened the doors for me. My mom was very psychic, so I got my training from her. Although it was, she wasn't a professional psychic, but I just randomly and frequently had paranormal experiences, everything from telepathy and telekinesis and, alien contact and ghosts and cryptids. And I'm like a lightning rod for the paranormal. But the problem was that I couldn't really talk about it. Every profession I was in, whether it was the military, I was 6 years in the Army, working at Boeing as a defense contractor, couldn't really talk about the stuff. Or in academics for the, teaching and as a professor for the last 30 years, not really good venues for talking about this kind of stuff. So what happened is in 2016, a friend of mine passed away and I had a vision, just which isn't unusual for me. But in this case, my friend Gene passed away and he came to me and said that it was time to start telling my stories, publishing my stories, and even gave me the name of the book, Timeless, because he said, we're all timeless. There's no future, no past. Everything's the eternal now. And he just shared a bunch of information with me and gave me the courage to step out and step forward and start telling these stories. Little did I know I'd write 3 books. So it's a trilogy, Timeless, Timeless Deja Vu, and Timeless Trinity. But then, as we talked about last time, I started talking about Anzar and I thought, with the help of Terry Lovelace, whom you know, he convinced me you should write a book just have it just what Anzar has told you and your conversations with him, and which is what I did. So this is the fourth paranormal book. And if you look at my publications, I've published 12 books. I did all these standard academic books, and then all of a sudden, whoa, real turn. You know, I started doing all these paranormal books. So, which I'm glad I did. There haven't been any retributions. Everything that I was afraid of, you know, that I'd lose my job or students would laugh at me or my colleagues would abandon me or whatever. None of that has happened. In fact, I teach a paranormal class at my college. They allow me to do that. We haven't done it for the last year because of what's been going on, but next year we're going to start it up again. So that's kind of a long story short. You name the experience, I've had it. And I don't think I'm anything special. I just, for some reason, the spirits liked it. Well, I started my first book by saying, it's not that I believe in ghosts, it's that they believe in me. So I don't have a choice. I kind of feel the same way with aliens too. You know, I don't have to decide whether I believe in them or not because they believe in me. So there you go. So I have the experiences.
That's really interesting. And I've talked to so many people who had similar experiences for, you know, much of their life. Do you think, you know, why do you think some people through most of their lives, they can have paranormal experiences, they can have contact experiences, mm-hmm. and some will never have anything. And they can be with this person who's having this experience, and this mm-hmm. person could be seeing something, and they'll never see that the thing that that person saw. Is it just that, you know, some people, they have this opening to the other side, to seeing things beyond our spectrum? What do you think?
Well, I think, that's basically what it is. I think everybody has paranormal experiences, but not everybody acknowledges it. They write it off as a coincidence or whatever, or they just don't want to think about it. So they just kind of stuff it into the back of their mind. And then eventually they'll have to deal with it probably. But rather than just accepting it, and once you accept it and believe it, then you get more experiences because it leads to more, get more experiences, more belief, deeper. It just keeps going deeper and deeper. So it's a matter of accepting it, not being afraid of it. Although I do think, you know, with the paranormal, you got to be cautious. You know, I don't think it's like a, you know, hey, let's let everything happen. You know, I think you have to be very careful. And that goes for alien contact too. You know, although you have less control, you know, it's not really control. It's more of a management system that I guess I have. But just some people are more attuned to it. And I think it was Whitley Strieber who said that with the aliens anyway, he said that they can see some people just have a glow about them, which indicates that it'd be easier to contact them. So go for those guys. You know, don't waste your time with other people who aren't going to even acknowledge you. And I think it's the same for ghosts too. They're not going to go to people who don't believe in ghosts and aren't going to even accept the fact that there's somebody trying to contact them. So they're just not going to waste their time. They're going to, because it takes a lot of energy for them to get down to our level. And it takes a lot of energy for us to get up to their level. So, vibration or whatever you want to call it, consciousness, I call it more than vibration, but it's a similar concept.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I like how you said believing is a big part of it, because mm-hmm. after I've had my first experience and I kind of accepted it and came to believe in it more, happened, and it kind of mm-hmm. led me on my path. It kind of threw signs and synchronicities at me that I should be doing this and this. It was all connected to this paranormal experience, and it's strange how that can happen.
Yeah, once you realize that it's all connected, you know, this, in fact, the first half of the new Anzar book is research that I've done on the connection between the spirit world, the alien world, and the quantum world, what I call the quantum nexus, that it's all really the same thing. And I developed and it's not just me that has this theory or thesis. There's, you know, much smarter people than me, but you know, that's what I develop in the first part. So there's a lot of footnotes and a lot of kind of research that I do for my regular history and political science books, but it's dedicated towards this quantum nexus. And then the second half of the book is all the contact that I've had with Anzar, this one particular entity, this ancient alien mystic, what he's told me, the wisdom he's given me, the predictions, prophecies, and preparations he's given me. And so that's what I share in the second half of the book. And all of that is based on having these, what I call spirit walks, which are really just meditative walks that I take where I get into my meditative state and have my, you know, my mediumship experience, which could include Anzar. It could include dead relatives, you know, people that have passed on in my life, or other people's relatives if I've been asked to do that. Or my friend Gene, who started the whole thing. I always have to mention Gene every time I get interviewed, because if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have had the courage to write the first book, and you know, none of this would have happened. We wouldn't be talking right now. I'd be hidden away somewhere doing some mundane task, you know, instead of talking, you know, talking to you about this exciting stuff. And it is exciting because it's there is a paradigm shift going on, and I know, you know, you know it, and a lot of people know, but there's a lot of people that haven't quite sensed it yet. So it's a big responsibility. When you've had these experiences, you have a responsibility to everybody to help them understand. And a show like yours, or books that I write, or whatever, you know, all of our friends that are involved in this are doing their part. Everybody has a mission. Everybody's doing their part to do what Anzar calls a leap of consciousness, the next evolutionary leap for step for human beings. And so as a long answer to the short the short question about why some people and not others, really it's just everybody has these experiences, they just don't acknowledge it. And like in my class, I'll have people in my paranormal class that are believers, lots of experience. I'll have people that are really interested, but they're so frustrated. I've just never had an experience. And then I'll have a couple skeptics too, which is always fun because you get to, you know, commiserate with them, and it's fun. But the people who claim they've never had an experience, that the first day I always ask, well, have you ever felt like somebody was staring at you, and then you turned around and somebody was staring at you? And they all, yeah, I've had. I said, well, that's paranormal,
right?
That's paranormal. You know, have you ever prayed? You know, what do you think praying is? You know, praying is a form of meditation. It's a form of communication, spirit communication. You're communicating with God or Jesus or whatever the deity that you want to be praying to, Mother Nature, whatever, the creator. So, it's all connected. And I think people just, once they realize that, then they're open to it more. And then, like you said, once you're open to it, once you believe it, you've had an experience, it leads to more experiences.
Yeah, and it would make sense that everybody experiences this. Some people just don't realize it or mm-hmm. block it out. And yeah. Lately, I've spoken to so many contactees and abductees, a lot at recently mm-hmm. last week at the UFO conference, mm-hmm. that said that when they first started having these experiences, it was quite traumatic for them. They didn't yes. understand it, and it was terrifying. But once they looked back and or either had regressions or remembered or came mm-hmm. to understand what happened, it was actually a good experience or an enlightening experience. Yeah. And you said that that was similar for you, right?
Yeah, it's like, you know, like with weightlifting, no pain, no gain, you know. I don't mean to be glib about it, because some of these are very traumatic experiences. Like Terry Lovelace, it was very, very traumatic. My first experience in 64, it was actually a rescue experience. In fact, that's when I first met Anzar. I didn't know him as Anzar because I was just 6 years old. So I just knew it was a strange dude in my backyard showing me this. I didn't know it was a hologram, but he was showing me a ship. But the role that he played was that, long story short, was there was a neighbor that lived above us, and he was a weirdo. I mean, he was a real weirdo. I would go up there for them to babysit me sometimes. And I'm only 6 years old, right? But I knew something was up with this dude. He just acted like a kid. And it's different than like you have a funny uncle who does, you know, it's kind of a fun, it's, he was creepy. And even as a little kid, I knew he was creepy. And so anyway, Anzar came to me in my backyard, you know, this hologram, and he's, you know, this scary looking giant alien, you know, with the slanted eyes and the upside down teardrop shape head, a robe. And he tells me, you know, and I tell him, I said, well, you look like a monster. I'm just a kid. So I'm saying, you look like a monster. It's very terrifying. And he said, I'm not the monster. That man up there in that house is the monster, and you need to stay away from him. And so I believed him. And I said, well, can I tell my parents about you? And they said, well, as it turned out, he was Anzar, but I didn't know him as that at the time. he said, well, you can tell them, but they're probably not going to believe it. But whatever you do, don't go up to that house anymore. And I said, well, what, my mom, you know, they're friends with, my mom was friends with the lady, you know, up there in that house. So I said, well, what do I tell her? And I said, just tell your mom you don't want to go up there, and your mom will agree. And she did. My mom didn't argue. She said, okay, you don't want to go up there anymore. That's fine. Turned out later, the guy, all my suspicions were correct, even though I was only six. He was a child molester. He's now passed away, thank goodness. But who knows how many children, you know, were, you know, impacted by that. But so that was my first experience. Now, so it's a rescue experience. It's a good experience, right? In the long run, it's good. I didn't get subjected to that horrifying thing. But it was so traumatic that for 2 years, I had to go to speech therapy. I couldn't talk. I suddenly lost my ability to talk. I would stammer and stutter so badly that I couldn't even communicate. And I stopped trying at school. So they put me, you know, 2 hours a day in speech therapy. Thank goodness after 2 years, I was able to start talking again. I felt, you know, like I have, you know, the ability to do that. Now, of course, I can't stop talking. You know, I talk for a living. So it's kind of odd that way. But so it was traumatizing in that way. And I did some research in the book about that type of speech impediment. And that's one of the ways that kids develop speech impediments is stuttering is through a traumatic experience. So the two kind of go together. So that's kind of how I relate what's happened to me to the research, you know, which is kind of fun to have some kind of research basis to your experiences.
Definitely.
Gives it more gravitas, you know.
Yeah, and that's a good introduction into what we're going to be talking about, your experiences mm-hmm. with ANZAR. Now, this first experience when you were a child, how old did you say you were around?
Six. It was 1964.
Yeah. And is this all you remembered? Is this the only communication at this point that you had with him, that he told you about this man?
Yeah, that's all I remembered.
And did you get any feelings like coming off of this being?
Like, well, after I got over his scariness, you know, and him saying that I'm not a monster, and I could see he was gentle and he wasn't acting weird. He was acting like, you know, a grandfather or something. He was very, very nice and comforting. So I realized, even though I was traumatized by the initial contact, he didn't really tell me anything else other than he did show me a holographic image of a ship, I suppose his ship. And he told me that one day I would fly. Now I thought I was going to be an astronaut. Of course, a lot of kids thought they were going to be astronauts in the 60s, you know, cause it was the big thing. As it turned out, I did end up flying. I was a helicopter pilot in the Army. I was like compelled to go in that route. So, you know, he was correct. I did end up flying and I love aviation. My wife is also a pilot. So that's kind of cool. But that was my first experience with him. But like I said, I didn't know his name. I didn't know anything about him. I didn't understand I just thought it was another unusual thing that happened to me. And I figured everybody else had these unusual things too. But I learned pretty quickly not to talk too much about it, because when I went to school and I tried to talk about this thing or my invisible playmates and things like that, I would get told, oh, that's not real. And I remember, you know, going home crying to my mom. My mom said, you know, I know that it's real and we know it's real, but don't push it on other people, because then you'll just get into trouble. So I kind of learned quickly that you have to just not talk about it, although it doesn't stop the experiences though.
Now, when was the next encounter with ANZAR, and what happened then?
Well, as far as I know, the next experience I had wasn't, I don't think he was directly involved with, there was an abduction experience in 73 and 77 and 78, but it wasn't, ANZAR was not involved with that. It wasn't until 1997 that I had another, now he might have been monitoring me or checking on me, I don't know. But my next contact with him, you know, that I remember was in 1997. And I had a vision of him. This time he told me he was called the Progenitor. And he appeared to me very, very tall, again in a robe. This time he looked more proto-human. He kind of had this proto-human look, you know, to him, like a hairy face and, you know, those kind of features, kind of a broad nose. And He told me he was the progenitor. He said that he was the first contact on Earth. And I was writing down every word he was talking about, stuff that I didn't really understand that well at the time. Black holes go into another dimension, into a parallel universe, into a quasar, and that's how things are connected. And I was drawing all these pictures of how that would look. And I had been drawing those pictures even before that experience in 97. I just kept drawing these pictures of a funnel, you know, going in one hole and coming out another. I kept drawing that. So it was a very Zen-like experience. You know, he was saying, you know, that one of the things he said was that the bargain for love is hate and war is peace. And, you know, it's very Zen-like, you know, to me, that's what it sounded like. I drew a picture of him. I wrote down every word he said, but I didn't share it with anybody until 2001, when I thought I found a safe colleague where I teach. She was a anthropology professor. She's passed away now. May she rest in peace. But I went up to her and I showed her the picture and I told her, you know, the story, the progenitor, and she listened politely, and then she looked at me and she said, "You're a pretty spacey dude, aren't you?" And it was a very negative experience. So I thought she'd be safe because she studied shamanism and ancient cultures and stuff. I thought she'd be, you know, kind of cool with it. She wasn't. So I just clammed up, didn't really talk about it. Paranormal things kept happening, right? And then I had that experience with Jean in 2016 and started writing and publishing my stories. And in 2018, I decided to contact the progenitor again. And I'd been talking to Jean and my mom and dad and other spirits, you know, in my spirit walks, but I decided to contact the progenitor. And that's when I asked him, you know, "Have you been with me this whole time? And what's your name? I know you're the progenitor," but that's when he told me his name was Anzar. So for the last 3 years, I've been in constant contact. When I take about 3 or 4 spirit walks a week, anywhere from 2 to 5 miles. And during a certain part of it, I will get into a meditative state as I'm walking. I'm not one of those sitting meditators. I have to move. So I contact him and I record everything. Now you don't hear his voice in the recording. It's just my little phone with the voice app, you know, recording app. And I hear what he says in my head. I record it into my recorder along with my questions. And over the last 3 years, I got about 300 pages of notes, of transcripts from all those communications, not just with him, but with Gene and other spirits. And it was from that I condensed into the Anzar book, from those that contact. So that's what I've been doing, and keeping, you know, some of my CERO friends, you know, the Close Encounter Resource Organization friends, like Terry Lovelace and Yvonne Smith and others, James Lowe, telling them what I'm hearing and sharing it with them.
Now, before we get into some of the information that Anzar provided for you, you said you had 3 other abduction experiences kind of in between the Anzar experiences. Do you know if these were related to Anzar, if it was, you know, kind of related to the same thing, or were these completely different beings? Could you give us a little synopsis of what happened?
Yeah, I don't believe he was involved, although he could have been aware, but I don't remember him being directly involved with it. In 73, that was what I call special processing. So anyway, in 73, it was Christmas Eve. My aunt and uncle from Norway were visiting. I went downstairs into my downstairs bedroom. Everybody was still upstairs. They were having cognac or something, smoking cigars. And I fell asleep. And when I woke up, my cat jumped off the bed. He was startled and jumped off the bed. I looked in the doorway and there was my aunt. And I thought, what's my aunt doing in my doorway? But then my aunt, the image of my aunt, kind of morphed into this almost like a reptilian looking alien, you know, that I knew it was not a human. And there were little, you know, what we would now call the little grays around this reptilian looking alien. The next thing you know, I'm paralyzed and I'm like levitating above the bed. And then I start to rise up and everything dissolves. And next thing I know, I just seen the stars, and I end up on a table, the kind of the classic, you know, story of an abduction. And on this table, I'm surrounded by there's some grays around like the foot of it. And at the head of this exam table, I call it an exam table because it was very much a medical type of thing. There was like a harness on my head or something that seemed like it. There was an insectoid there. And I call him Dr. Bug. And Terry Lovelace and I think we had the same doctor. So we both call him Dr. Bug. But I was pretty terrified. You know, I asked what's going on. And he said, just, you know, calm down. He was he didn't have a very good bedside manner, but he wasn't cruel or anything. He was just all business, you know. And he said, you're here for special processing. And I, you know, I started to ask some questions and he said, that's all I can tell you. And he just touched my head. And then I don't remember anything else other than I'm settling back into my bed and my cat jumps back up on the bed. So that's what happened in 73. In 77, it was a dual experience. I was with a friend of mine and we were 18 years old. We just graduated from high school and we were driving to Salt Lake City and then we're gonna go to Las Vegas, LA, back up the coast, back to Seattle. We're from Seattle. And we only got as far as Idaho, the wilderness area of Idaho. And we decided we were too tired to drive any further. So there was a place called Black Pine Peak. There was a campground there. It was pitch black. You know, we drove off the highway up this dirt road, couldn't find the campground. So we just ended up at a clearing on the side of this dirt road. Well, that's when the weirdness started happening. It was, I remember we were sleeping in the car. We didn't even have, it's too dark to put up a tent. So we were just sleeping in the car. And I remember that seemed like there were people outside of the car, but I couldn't move. And then there was these weird lights, you know, and it wasn't like, at first I thought, oh, there's another car driving up, but they were like too high and different angles and stuff. And I thought that doesn't look right, but I couldn't do anything about it. Oddly enough, I felt, you know, almost like I'd been drugged or something. That's what it felt like. And weird noises, weird smells, you know, kind of like a ion smell, like it's going to rain or something. And those are the conscious memories I have of that experience. At that point, I contacted Yvonne Smith and I said, I need to do, you know, you do regressions. I'm kind of afraid of it, but I think I need to talk about this. And so I did a regression. And as it turned out, one of the first things she did is put me right back, you know, relaxed me. I got right back there. What I had remembered, I'm kind of paralyzed in my seat. And she said, she's very good. She doesn't lead you on. She just said, look at the passenger side and what is your friend doing? So in, you know, as I'm remembering this, I look and I said, he's gone. He's not there. Where's Ernie? I call him Ernie in the story. He's gone. Well, as it turned out, Ernie had been taken. He was abducted. That's what happened. I witnessed the thing of him being taken. I don't know exactly what happened to him, but, so after that regression, I decided to contact Ernie and I said, I called him and I said, Ernie, I'm going to write a story about our experience. What do you remember about that trip? Well, he remembered all the stuff I had said, all the conscious memories. And then I said, okay, well, I'm going to, I think it was an abduction. And then he just flipped out on me. He just got really angry and he said, no, it wasn't. It was just, you know, a weird thing. And he said, if you would have told me that, I would have hung up the phone right away. And you're just trying to trick me into, you know, maybe I should publish a story and, you know, and I don't want to talk to you anymore about this. And then he hung up the phone. I kept trying to call, emailed him, nothing. And then finally he emailed me back and he sent me this really weird email where, and I told him, I was very sorry. I didn't mean to, you know, cause him harm or, you know, make him feel bad or whatever. That wasn't my intent. I just wanted to find out what happened. And I was hoping he would acknowledge it. Well, he emailed me and said, you know what? I do remember what happened. And I was taken. And probably the reason you feel bad is because you allowed the aliens to take me. And I remember them telling me, this one's a squealer. You think he'd never seen a set of pincers before? He used the word pincers, right? That's a scary term, right? So very, you know, the image comes to mind. So, and then he's never talked to me since. That was, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago. And I talked to Yvonne about it, and she said, that's very typical when two people have an experience, one of them will remember and want to deal with it. And the other one will shut them out and deny it, or even acknowledge it, but then just cut off the friendship, which is what happened, unfortunately. Well, man, I had to go one step further because I want proof. I'm a historian. I need documentation, right? So what documentation do I have? Well, I wrote a bunch of poems around that time. So I was digging through my old poetry, and I had a poem that I wrote in 1977 after that summer trip, that we road trip. And the name of the poem was I Sold Out to the Aliens. That's what it was, right on the nose, right? And then I read it and I thought, man, I'm lamenting wow. about how I had allowed things to happen. And then at the end, it says, it mentions pincers in the poem, you know, and my jaw dropped, and I go, I didn't remember writing that, but yeah, that's what Ernie said. And that's what's in the poem. And then I thought, wow, that's amazing. I know that's kind of a long story, but anyway, it's cool because it involves hypnotic regression, conscious memories, a second party, and then some documentation from that time period. So it kind of has a bunch of different things together.
Yeah, that is really cool. Yeah, and go ahead.
No, that's fine. I had another one too, but yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, before you get into that one, I thought it was also interesting when you said the doctor-like insect being that Terry, you know, could have experienced the same thing. I've also heard, you know, other abductees saying that these insect beings were in the role of like some kind of doctor or scientist. Yeah. So I thought that was really interesting.
That's the role.
Go ahead and tell us about this other one too.
Yeah, it's just, no, it's like we're talking about the same guy. That's why we both call him Dr. Bug. But I have another experience with him too. But anyway, this in 1978, I was at a low point in my life, it's tough to talk about, but I was about to commit suicide. I had a knife to my throat. My only question at the time was, am I going to slit my throat, or am I going to do the, you know, like the Japanese soldiers in World War II, that kind of thing. And it was this rusty old hunting knife. It was terrible. I'd lost my job. My parents were mad at me. My brother was mad at me. I'd broken up with my girlfriend because I was being a jerk. I just lost everything. I had no money. I'm sleeping on this dirty mattress on my brother's garage floor, and he's about to kick me out, you know, even there, you know, 'cause I'm living there for free. So I decide I'm going to end it. Well, I'm just about to do this, and all of a sudden there's this particle beam. It seemed like it shot up out of the floor, but it was connected up through the ceiling of the garage. And it was almost like a fire, but it was like particles, right? And it was like this low rumbling sound, and it was a tremendous experience. I mean, it's like I was frozen. I couldn't do anything. Next thing I know, I'm like being carried up through the ceiling. I can see the stars, right? And I'm carried up. I don't go to a ship or anything. I just up into the heavens, and it's beautiful. And then I come back down gently back onto this dirty old mattress. And when I come back down, I had no intent of wanting to kill myself. I had just lost that. I just thought, that's ridiculous. I would never do that. And so I count that as another rescue. There was some reason that I was supposed to not carry that out at that time. So there was an intervention at that time. So that's what happened in 1978. Subsequent to all this, you know, I've had, talking about the bug, Dr. Bug, I was in San Diego visiting my cousin, who's also an experiencer. So it runs in families. She's my blood cousin. And we were talking, I was telling her about Dr. Bug, about this experience. And all of a sudden, we're in this outside restaurant in San Diego. It's not windy or anything. This pipe with a outlet on it just starts to swing back and forth really wildly, just back and forth. And I thought, somebody just, they must be, I looked up there. There's nobody, you know, manipulating it. There's no wind to speak of. Nobody brushed by. And I told her, I said, look at that. We were just talking about Dr. Bug. And look at this thing. And she looked and she said, wow, that's weird. And that night when I went to sleep, I woke up in the middle of the night and I heard a voice, and I assume it was Dr. Bug, and he told me, oh, so now you think you know everything. And he said it in a very condescending voice. He wasn't mean, but he was like, oh, now you think you know everything, huh? You know, kind of like that. So I thought it was pretty funny, actually. So I don't think he's mean. I think he's just doing a job. I don't know who he's working for. I don't think he's the boss. I think other people are the boss. He's just kind of like the medical guy, you know, doing his job. And that's the same impression Terry has had too, you know, that it was, he's just doing his job, nothing personal. But if you were going to pick an HMO doctor, you wouldn't pick him. Right.
Right.
But, you know, but he wasn't evil or anything, you know.
Yeah. It's it'd be fascinating to find out some of the roles that these beings play whenever they're you know, carrying out some of this stuff. But I want to get a little bit back to Anzar. How do you know that the information Anzar has given you, that he's not trying to deceive you in any way, that, you know, he's not, been a big ruse?
Yeah, it's a good question, because having had these experiences with, you know, when I first started doing my spirit walks, I wasn't very careful with protection. So I'd go out there, I wouldn't do my prayers of protection. I wouldn't ask my spirit guides to help me and protect me. I wouldn't do my prayers that I do like I do now. I just went out there, put up my radar dish, and just, okay, what can I pick up? And you know, all kinds of weird things were happening. And most of it was not malevolent, but it was annoying. It was like things that would just, like people, you can imagine like a single doorway and hundreds of people trying to get through this door at the same time. It was just chaos, you know, and there's just a cacophony of noise and, you know, desires, you know, these spirits wanting to talk. So it's very important to be discerning about how you do go about this, whether it's aliens or spirits or whatever. It's the same realm, you know, so the quantum realm. But so how I know, some of the things he tells me, and I've tested him, but you know, he has a good sense of humor, which is always a good sign. You know, evil beings usually don't have a great sense of humor. But he always tells me, every single time I talk to him, he tells me, always keep love in your heart and operate from a position of love. Now, if he had evil intent, he would not be telling me that. He wouldn't tell me that every single time. And I wouldn't be taking it to heart and trying to put it in practice in my life, which, by the way, is extremely difficult. It's easy to say, very difficult to do, especially in the polarized world that we live in right now at this moment, especially in this country, but really in the world. And because people have asked me, how do you know, he's not like a demon or something trying to deceive you? And I said, well, I don't think a demon would say that. And all the stuff he's told me has been very kind and very helpful, not vindictive, not mean, you know, occasionally funny. Like, he'd tell me stuff like, one of the main missions we have in this world is to help alleviate the suffering of others. So I don't think an evil entity would stress that. He said that you cannot use alien technology to harm other beings, which is interesting. And I'm just reading from this because I want to make sure I get the words right. And this one is really cool. He said, along those lines, he said, extraterrestrial technology and wisdom are precious gifts for all, not a strategic advantage for the few. Which is extremely important now because, as you know, and everybody knows, that this report is coming out, the 25th. It's already been leaked like crazy. It's a very leaky report, I guess. But, you know, and then there's the classified version, and then there's the leaked version, which basically says the government's, okay, we acknowledge that we don't know what these things are. They're real, but we don't know what they are. But they don't want to talk about aliens, you know, which is weird because they're going to say, that it's not ours, it's not our adversaries, but we don't know what they are. And they're going to leave it at that. And then, of course, the question that begs itself, well, if they're not any human technology, then it kind of rules out, you know, everything.
Exactly.
But they're not, they don't want to say that, right? And right. I think part of it's because most, not just our government, I don't want to trash our guys, but I think every government's going to look at it this way as a defense matter, as a strategic, a national defense matter. And as one guy who is part of the intelligence community who I talked to, he said, hey, listen, they're all trying to figure out how to strap a bomb to this stuff. You know, that's what they want to do. And so you can gain a strategic advantage over your enemies. And Anzar's telling me straight out, no, that's not what it's for. You're not, it's a precious gift for all, which means we're supposed to all take this leap of consciousness into our next step of evolution. So all that stuff tells me that this is a legitimately kind, benevolent being. And so,
what is some of the, some of the most profound information that he's given you so far?
Well, he's talked about some of the technology where he's given me glimpses within visions that I've had where I was inside of one of the craft, I guess, one of the UAVs or UFOs. And I was shown that the person, and it was interesting because it looked like a US military person, came up with this, like this thing with a handle. It wasn't very big. It almost looked like a graphite rod or something. And he stuck it inside of this receptacle in this UFO in the center of it. And all of a sudden, everything just came to life, you know? And he said, it's alive. That's what he told me. He said, it's alive, you know? So this is the kind of stuff that Anzar is planting in my mind. And what happened was that the seemingly solid surface around me, you know, the fuselage or whatever you would call it, all of a sudden disappeared and you could see everything through it. It was still there, but it was like transparent. And then the thing was moving. It made absolutely no sound. And I was whizzing around and nobody even knew we were there. You know, that was really cool. Like 5 feet off the ground, there's people walking next to you and they don't even know you're there. It was the most awesome experience. It was really cool. So he shows me stuff like this so I can kind of understand why this, you know, why some people can see them, some people can't, why sometimes they might be phased in where you see a solid, looks like a solid thing. Other times it's transparent. You don't see it. They don't see you, although you can see them from inside. Some of the stuff he said, which I think is pretty cool, he said, you know what will happen in the future because you manifest it, which gives you a lot of, it's empowering. It's very empowering, you know, because we sometimes feel like we're just at the, you know, the mercy of fate, you know, whatever somebody else is going to do. In fact, I have a problem with the whole word disclosure. I know a lot of people have talked about it recently, but I really have a problem with it because it's so other directed. It's like, I'm going to sit here and wait patiently while my government tells me what the truth is. I don't think so. I think you and I and a lot of other people already know what the truth is. We just want more confirmation. We want more information. We want a sharing of the information. But, you know, sitting there and waiting for a disclosure, somebody disclosing to you what is going on, is a very other directed thing. So he prefers to call this experience not disclosure. He calls it revelation. It's a revelation with all that entails. You know, there's a religious version of that word. And then there's the idea that something that it will be revealed to you internally. You'll understand it. You'll be part of it. You know, you'll be part of it. And that's rather than somebody else giving it to you, it comes from you. You have a deep understanding, like an epiphany, you know, kind of like an epiphany or a radiant moment where you understand it. But anyway, so it's very empowering. You know, we know what's going to happen in the future because you manifest it. Him and Gene both have said, we are the aliens. And at first I thought, wait a second. So you're telling me you guys are the aliens, right? You know, because my friend Gene said it too. And I said, you mean like people who have passed on, you're the aliens? He said, we are all the aliens. He qualified and said, we're all connected. This is a homecoming. We're all connected. And Anzar has told me that I am connected to him. We're all connected to him. He was the progenitor. He was the first contact. And we are all connected. We're connected to all these beings. So there's a reason why they just didn't come here and destroy us or take over or whatever. I mean, we're family, maybe very distant past or distant future, depending on if you're talking about the time travel thing where maybe distant future humans are coming back, which my friend Michael Masters at Montana Tech wrote a book about that. His book is called Identified Flying Objects, I think. And that's his thesis, is that these are future humans coming back. I think it's a combination of all that. But he's the one who told me that the alien spirit and quantum worlds are all the same thing. So that put me on the track to do the research and find other people who have done similar research. There's 45 different things.
Now, someone wanted
to
ask,
in the back of the book,
is that earlier you mentioned how you believe that with this mainstream disclosure stuff, of course they want to strap bombs to whatever these things are.
Yeah.
But I don't trust any of it. I don't think that they're coming across at all with a narrative that's real, anything mm-hmm. that's really going on behind the scenes. I think it's beyond our understanding. And of course, they're trying to portray it as somewhat of a threat, it seems. Yeah. Has ANZAR given you any information about what's really going on with this disclosure stuff?
Yeah, well, he says they don't know what they're dealing with. That's because they're so channeled into this threat scenario that it's almost beyond their ability to understand it. And that's why they've had so much difficulty with it, because they think, well, we can just reverse engineer it. If we have pieces of alien technology, we can just reverse engineer it, but nothing is working. Otherwise, you know, 70 years of this stuff, we would have, had a lot more stuff going on. But he said that they don't really understand. They have the wrong mindset. He said, it's not a military situation, it's a spiritual opportunity for growth, an evolutionary step. That's what it is. And until people start thinking that way, they're not going to see what it really is. They're not going to be able to utilize it. They're not going to be able to understand it, which is always, I've told my friends at CIRO, is that eventually these government types are probably going to reach out to, and I know they already are to some experiencers. Like I know Terry Lovelace, for instance, they're going to start picking brains and wanting to know, what do you guys know? What do we don't understand? Can you help fill in the blanks here? And whenever they're ready to receive that information, I'd be more than happy to share, like with you or anybody else, to have a serious discussion about the puzzle piece that I have. I'm not saying I have all the pieces. I don't. I have one little puzzle piece. All of us have a little piece. We need to put them together. We can't hide them and store them away because, somebody else might get an advantage over us and they'll put a bomb on it before we do, and then we'll be at their mercy. And, that kind of attitude has got us stalled out where we are right now.
Yeah, one thing that's become very clear is that we probably shouldn't be looking into the skies to other planets and solar systems, that probably these beings are all around us at all times. It's more of an interdimensional type thing, just beyond the spectrum of our vision, that all this life probably exists, and we're just looking at it the wrong way. Like you said, it's more of a spiritual and interdimensional thing that they don't understand, and it probably scares the hell out of a lot of them.
Yeah. I think you're right. And I was, when I was a little kid, I had these ideas. I was a strange kid, but I hang out at graveyards. I felt very comfortable there. I've always had a very strange outlook on things, but I remember watching the movie, The Incredible Shrinking Man, and that left such an impression. I was like a 1956 movie, one of those 50s creature features, whatever, that I used to watch on Saturday mornings. And in that movie, he just shrinks to oblivion, right? And the idea is, I thought, wow, the universe is without end, is so it's bigger than we can even imagine. And also there's an incredibly tiny world too that we can't see. It's infinite. In other words, our existence is both infinitely small and infinitely large at the same time. And, I was thinking, as a little kid, I was thinking this, and I still think about that. I used to think, I put it in the terms I understood. So I said, well, maybe I'm living inside of a giant, in the stomach of a giant, and maybe that giant is living in the side of the stomach of another giant, and there might be someone living in my stomach. That's how I saw it as a little kid, that it just kept going both ways. So I think you're right. I think they just... those in power are kind of blinded by ambition, by their power struggle, by their perception as a military threat, that type of stuff. Not that we shouldn't have a military, but in this case, that is not the answer. And I think that's very clear. And it's not just me that thinks that. There's many, many people who have had experiences that think the same thing and feel the same mission. And I think someday, I tend to be optimistic. I think someday they'll actually listen. And they'll say, hey, I know we've been telling you guys are nuts. And well, I mean, just even the existence of a UAP, that's a step forward, right? Because it was only a couple of years ago, if you were to, you know, before 2017 or whatever, that, oh, those Roswell people, those UFO people, they're just all nuts. And now here you go. Every major television news, senators, congressmen, you know, from Harry Reid to Marco Rubio and everybody in between, they're all acknowledging these things. You know, the Navy, military pilots, and, you know, everybody's coming forward now. I have a friend of mine who's an airline pilot, and he's seen UFOs too, but he can't talk about it at work. So maybe the disclosure, the revelation comes from the people. It's a grassroots thing, and that'll force everybody to realize, to acknowledge it. It has to come from us. We can't wait for it to come top down, because that ain't going to happen. Not in any kind of expedient manner, you know, not in a, in, because it's been 70 years, right? And they're still compartmentalizing everything.
Yeah. Now, one of the things you said, Anzar kind of explained to you, that we may experience a leap of consciousness and an error of reconversion. Could you kind of explain what he meant by that?
Yeah, that's a really cool concept. And I had to think about it and ask him a lot of questions, follow-up questions, kind of like a press conference. You know, he'd take in information. Then a week later, I'd ask him again, well, wait a second, what did you mean by that? So this leap of consciousness is a evolutionary step for us to the next higher level, so that the greater majority of people will be able to experience telepathy. They'll be able to see UFOs and UAVs and have alien experiences. I mean, that's the next step, right? So we can communicate better. But the era of reconversion is necessary, because that's where we reconvert to our ancient selves, our true selves as human beings, the original, you know, when Anzar said he was the progenitor, right? People, early man, early humans, were very close to the earth. They understood their connection between the star. They didn't have maybe the scientific names that we have, but they understood the connection. They saw star people. You know, you talk to Native Americans, that's a tradition with them. They practiced magic, ritual magic. They had shaman and they had medicine men, and they had telepathy and telekinesis. They had all that stuff. And it was part of their society. They accepted it as part of their lives. And if you go now to remote areas of the world, people are more accepting of it. But in modern technological societies, we've drowned all that out, and we don't accept it anymore. So we say, well, science has replaced it. Well, I don't think we should replace science with going back in time. What we need to do is keep what we have, all the scientific achievements we have, and go through this reconversion where we put it back together with the ancient knowledge that we had. And then we're truly taking a giant leap in evolution. If we could do that, if we could retain what we lost from ancient societies, whether it's the Aborigines, the Native Americans, or in my case, the Sami people of, you know, the reindeer herders of the north, of the northern high north, if we can combine all that, then we're going to be much better off. We'll see how we fit into the universe. And that's what I'm hoping. I have a very optimistic view, ultimately, of what's going to happen. But I'm also realistic in that, you know, my main field of history is foreign policy. So that's really the study of wars, right? So we're going to have a lot of bumps in the road, a lot of conflict, you know, because once people realize these things are real, it's not just made up. Well, somebody's driving them, somebody's sending them, you know, and it's not the Russians, it's not the Chinese, or it's not the Americans, then obviously it's, well, that's going to shake everybody, a lot of religious groups, a lot of ultra-nationalist group, you know, whatever, they're just going to be shaken to their roots, and some people are going to get a little crazy. In fact, people are already getting a little crazy. So there's going to be some bumps in the road before we make that leap. And our job, the way I see it, experiencers, is to help calm people down and just realize these are necessary steps. There'll be growing pains, but they're necessary steps. And that's what Ansar is doing. He calls it nudges. He likes to give humankind nudges. So that's what he's been doing, giving you a little nudge. You know,
I've heard that before, hey, that they are kind of nudging us along until mm-hmm. we're ready, then they yeah. may contact us.
Yeah, and instead of just a handful of people or a few people or whatever, it'll be more prominent. It'll be part of our everyday lives, and we'll be much better off for it. And now that being said, he has admitted to me that there are extraterrestrial groups that are less than friendly. And there's a, you know, there's kind of a tension between them. You know, there's the Ansar types that are the friendly types that are trying to help us, give us nudges. There are those that are kind of observers, you know, more neutral. And then there are those that are rougher types, you know. A lot of people think that that's who the reptilians are. You know, they're kind of the rougher, you know, kind of the Klingons, you know, the, you know, right. only in real life, you know.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what he's been telling me. And I've heard that from other sources too, you know, from some government sources that some people are willing to acknowledge that, not publicly, but that there are, you know, there's more than one group. And that's what Ansar has told me about too. And he said, but the key is that, and there are bad human actors, you know, people that would be encouraged by those type, you know, there. So for every Ansar, there might be a anti-Ansar that's promoting somebody somewhere else that's saying, don't keep love in your heart, go for revenge. You know, maybe what you should do is really get revenge on your enemies all the time. You know, so maybe there's somebody like that. I don't know of their existence. I haven't asked Ansar directly that, but it's kind of an interesting question. Is there an anti version of you?
Yeah. And along those lines, I think that, you know, ever since this kind of mainstream disclosure movement started in 2017, that there's been intentional disinformation mm-hmm. agents put out there. I'm pretty sure, I'm 100% sure that this conference I just went to had some of those not only attending but presenting at the conference. You know,
I
don't trust
it.
Anybody's information. I take it in, I listen to mm-hmm. it and see what they have to offer and do my own research. But yeah, it's
That's
very
smart.
Interesting how many and how much disinformation has come up about the whole extraterrestrial phenomenon since it started going mainstream.
Yeah, you have to look at people's intentions, and that's where you know, psychic abilities really help, because I you know, before I learned how to manage my you know, my psychic abilities, I didn't like to go to parties, because I would I'd walk in and all of a sudden there's just all this noise, and it's not just the people talking with their mouths. I can hear not their thoughts, but their intentions. I can sense their intentions, and it's creepy. You know, I don't want to know what they're all intending to do. I don't want to know that stuff. I just want to go there and enjoy myself. So before I learned how to manage my ability to receive all this information, I would go into a corner or go outside and find one person and just talk to them and hope that I could drown out all the noise. So I didn't really enjoy parties. Now it's easier for me, because I just turn it off. It's like, I call it a radar dish. I just stow it away and I don't turn it on. And that way I can kind of tune out all that stuff. But if I bring up the radar dish, then I'll just start receiving everything. And it's not, people think, man, I'd really wish I could, you know, read people's thoughts or intentions or whatever. That'd be really cool. It's not really cool. It really isn't, unless it's a dangerous situation. Of course, you'd want to use it for survival. And I think that's where it comes from. I think that that's the sixth sense that our ancient ancestors had that kept them alive. And of course, the ones that had the best sixth sense would pass on their genetics, right, to the next generation who would, and they survived. You know, they're all survivors, fighters and resource specialists and, you know, and people that had this intuition or the sixth sense. So anyway, that's... It can be both a blessing and a curse. I think it's more of a blessing now that I know how to manage it better. It doesn't interfere with my daily life. I can turn it on and turn it off. That doesn't mean I don't make mistakes, because I don't know if I talked about it last time, but I made a terrible mistake in January 2019. As some TV producer had heard me on one of the shows, and called me up and said, I'd like to bring you out to Chicago. And I don't know if we talked about this last time, but
I don't think so.
I'd like to bring you out to Chicago. I'm putting together a documentary. I think you'd be perfect. You seem like the real deal. So I was like, oh, it's building up my ego. It's like, oh yeah, I can really, you know, shine here. So he said, I'll bring you out. I'll pay for your hotel and transportation, all that stuff, fly you out. And I said, well, one condition, I'd like my wife to come with me. And he said, okay, yeah, I'll pay for her too. So I said, okay, nothing to lose, you know? So we went out there. He took me to different sites. So he took me to like graveyards and old buildings, and I was picking up on stuff, you know, not totally impressive, but you know, cause he knew what was there. He didn't tell me. He just said, okay, I'm going to take you to this place. What do you pick up? He already knew what was going on there historically. So I didn't. So for the most part, I was doing okay. Not totally impressive, but then he took me to the south side of Chicago. And I had kind of a hit and miss day because he kind of debriefed me after each location. So I thought, man, I got to step up my game. So I wasn't doing any protection prayers, nothing. I just got out of the car, south side of Chicago, pulled into an Aldi's parking lot. There was this this old alleyway behind it. And I got out of the car and all of a sudden, boom, and I put my radar dish up, boom, I saw like from the 1890s, horses and buggies and people in black clothing rushing around. Nobody was paying attention to me. It's like I didn't exist. And I'm watching this like a movie, an old black and white movie, and or a cinescope or whatever. It was like a real, you know, stop action kind of thing. And but there was one guy staring at me, and he had a bowler hat, a big curly mustache, and very dark, scary eyes. He was staring at me, and he frightened me. And all of a sudden, the image went away, right? So I said, oh, I got to pick up on this again. So I walked into the alley, went to touch a tree, an old tree, and I thought I could pick up something. Rocks, trees, old buildings, if I touch them, sometimes I can pick up information. And as soon as I was about to touch the tree, I was like tackled into the ground. I mean, I thought I was actually, and I'm a big guy, I'm 6'3", about 275. But this force drove me into the ground, like I was helpless, like I was a baby, and held me down. Well, there was nobody there. It was just a psychic force that held me down. And as I was on the ground, I could see underneath the ground, like in a dungeon, there were men, women, and children who were being tortured. And they were like reaching for me. It was really scary. They were like reaching, trying to grab me and bring me down. And they were crying and wailing. And it was so scary. They're bleeding and oh, it was horrible. And I felt like I was giving up my will to live. It was awful. And then finally I broke through it. I got up, I had injured myself. The guy came running out of the car. He hadn't even had a chance to put the camera on yet, but I was mic'd up. And he said, what's going on? Cause I was narrating this whole thing. And I told him, and he said, oh, we better get out of here. You know? And he said, I feel funny too. You know? And he said, I feel strange. Got into the car. And I said, don't ever take me to some place like that. Because the only thing he told me is this was kind of a dark place. That's all he said. Didn't give me any other information. South side of Chicago, right? So we get in the car, we're driving away. And I said, what is this place? You got to tell me. And don't ever take me to a place like this again. And he said, well, in the 1890s, this was the location of the Murder Hotel, which was the site, you know, that's where Dr. H.H. Holmes, America's first serial killer, killed over 300 people in that murder hotel on that site in dungeons underneath. So I was seeing what had happened there. That site was still inhabited by his evil spirit or whatever demonic spirit possessed him or both, and actually physically harmed me, not only psychically harmed me, but physically harmed me. I injured my knee. I hyperextended my left toe. I mean, it was a very dangerous situation. So The lesson there is that, you know, pride goeth before the fall, right? I mean, I was trying to impress this TV producer, and I don't blame him because he was just wanted good shots, you know, he wanted something cool, you know, something dramatic. And I don't think he thought I'd be injured. So it was really scary. And there was some lingering effects when I went back to school and I was teaching my paranormal class. Some of my students who were professional psychics were getting sick because they said, you have attachments on you. So I had to go and get a shaman to do a cleansing and, you know, get that stuff off of me. So it was pretty bad. So the lesson there is always use protection. Don't go into some horrible place. You know, if somebody tells you, hey, there's a demon in there, you should go check it out. No, right. No, thanks. it's real. I know it's real. I don't need to go check anything out. You know, I know that it's real already, and I know what it can do to you. So,
yeah, good advice. Now, Bruce, we have a few minutes left. For the last few minutes, I'd like to get your thoughts on something you mentioned earlier, how it's all connected, the paranormal, ufology, through this something you call the quantum nexus. Yeah. I know it's probably the most difficult thing in the world to explain, but if you could maybe try and do your best to kind of explain what you think of this quantum nexus and how all this stuff is connected.
Yeah, so in quantum physics, that's really subatomic particles, how they operate. And basically, they are timeless, just like Gene said. They are timeless. They don't. There's no past. There's no future. It's just they're moving in every direction at once. It's that's how the subatomic world works, and everything's in wave form. And we can't see the subatomic world because we have our material reality that we see. We don't see, like, the desk in front of me looks solid, but in actuality, it's moving. It's all, in fact, we're connected to the desk, to the thing. We're connected to each other than through our, this connection here, this electronic connection, which is really just an interface. We're connected to everything, including the universe. So that's the way the quantum world works. And when you think of ghosts, let's start with ghosts. People report, and I've seen ghosts, they appear out of nowhere. They vibrate into our reality, our subjective reality. Then they vibrate out, they go through windows, doors, and so forth. Well, so do aliens. People who report seeing aliens, they come out of nowhere, they disappear, they can take you through a ceiling, in my case, or a window or a door. They're operating in the same realm. That's what gave me the clue was, wait a second, they're operating, they're doing the same kinds of things. They have ships that appear out of nowhere, then they disappear. You know, what's going on? And that is the quantum world. That's the quantum nexus being the connection. So I think that's where we have to operate from. So everything that's paranormal is operating in the quantum realm. Everything that's alien is operating in the quantum realm. Occasionally we'll get a little glimpse in our reality. There is a physicist named David Bohm who had three different levels. He said there was the explicate order, explicate reality, which is our everyday reality, how we're talking to each other now. There's the implicate, which is the quantum world, where the aliens, and in my view, and the spirits operate, and where quantum physics is in full effect. And then above that is the super implicate, which is the one consciousness, or the creator, or God, or whatever. And that's one thing that Ansar has made clear. He's not God, or even a minor God. He's just an ancient alien mystic, as he says, a humble alien ancient mystic. Even though he was our first and he was the one who gave us nudges, he doesn't say that he's any, a god or anything like that, which is very important because he's talked about the creator before. So anyway, that's my understanding of what the quantum nexus is. And I just love it. You know, I'm a historian, but I love science and math. I mean, I was going to be an engineer. I studied engineering and I love science and math, but I ended up, in history. But and I don't regret that. But anyway, that's my quick and dirty explanation.
We definitely live in fascinating times, and it's very exciting to see what's going on. Even though some of it's very concerning, I think that the future can be very interesting if we keep going in the right direction when it comes to looking at some of this stuff. But Bruce, I want to thank you again for coming on tonight. For everybody wants to pick up your new book, Ansar, the Progenitor, they can get it on Amazon.
Yeah. Amazon, all my books, the timeless books are on there too. So you can see the whole journey from the three timeless books to the Ansar book. And my website, BruceOlavSolheim.com, has all the other books I've done. You can see the turn that I took from traditional academics to the paranormal. And my plays that I do, write plays. I do a lot of different things. I have a lot of interest, Chris. I have a lot of interest, so. The world is a fascinating place, and the world beyond this world is even more fascinating.
It definitely
but you're
is.
Right. I wanted to mention, you're right to be careful. You know, I that's why I like having skeptics in my class, because they approach things, they're not debunkers. They're just, I'm just not sure. I don't know if that's right. Or not. I'm going to think about it. It's good to think about it. I'm skeptical sometimes when I hear something new. I think that's a healthy reaction.
Yeah, thank you. And it's definitely important, especially in the times we're living in right now with all the craziness and disinformation going on.
Oh, sure.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much again. Excellent information.
Thank you, Chris.
And of course, we'll have you back on in the future.
Oh, that would be cool. Thank you very much.
Have an excellent evening. And until next time, we'll see you all tomorrow.